Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Tennessee, well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
And then they trash him and say he's a fucking pill-popping, you know, pothead or whatever when he left.
Fuck you, Daddy.
I don't know the fuck the Department of Health is.
To do worse than Josh Richard. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, once again coming at you from the PTB Man Cave, and once again without my microphone, so bear with us. Only another episode, I think, and of course, let me bring in my PIC, Scott Criscola, because we have an excellent show lined up for you tonight, once again.
JR, it is always a pleasure, sir, and welcome everyone to episode, I believe... It is 158, and it is episode 158 of the Place to Be Podcast. And it is an unprecedented episode tonight. We'll tell you why. Because not only, of course, for those that are new to the show, we, of course, give you the awesome Vintage Vaults, our excellent headline shows, NFL predictions, and the like. But I think a lot of times I think the backbone of what makes us a great show and a great podcast for all of you is our excellent guest interviews. This one tonight is particularly going to be great. Why? Because this guy is such a great guest. For the first time in Place to Be Podcast history, we actually have a sequel. We never have a sequel. Other than The Godfather Part 2, they really aren't that good. Tonight's will be good. He was with us a couple weeks ago, and he was awesome. He's going to be awesome again tonight. Formerly Downtown Bruno. Formerly Harvey Whippleman. Formerly Hervina. We'll get to that later. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, Bruno Lauer. Bruno, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me again, and you'll have to refresh my memory of where we left off last time. I don't want to repeat any of the same stories and get the listeners bored.
Well, let's see. If I remember correctly, we left off middle of 1995, and you had just started managing. Bertha Faye came on the scene and would eventually become the World Wrestling Federation Women's Champion. How did that? I'm not sure if you did brush on it the last show, but tell us how that connection, that relationship, got started.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously the office put us together, which was fine. And as far as a person, me and her did not get along at all. We were not friends by any means. I wouldn't say we were enemies, but we were damn close. You know, I mean, I didn't care for her. I really didn't. We didn't get along well. We didn't do business well together. She had a lot of problems. That being said, I certainly, by no means, am I happy or glad or whatever that she, you know, had so many inner demons, so much inner turmoil that she committed suicide. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. I mean, I really wouldn't. I mean, she must have been suffering something that nobody can figure out. You know, I have to be honest, though. You know, like, right after it happened, the guy from the WWE magazine called me up and said, you know, I must be devastated. We must have been very close. And I told him, I'm not one of those hypocrites that's going to lie just because somebody died and say, oh, yeah, we were so close. Whatever it was, we weren't. I didn't care for her. And truthfully, you know, I'm sure she didn't care for me either. We just never clicked. But, again, that has nothing to do with how, you know, the tragic ending of her lifespan, and I certainly don't wish that on her or anyone else in the business.
How was the business part of working with her, though? Obviously, you weren't close, you weren't friends, but did it you know, was a successful house show tour, TV. You know, she had the one feud with Lunder Blaze, and that was pretty much it. Any thoughts on just the women's division at that time and kind of its standing in the promotion?
Well, I mean, you know, they attempted to make a good run of it with her and Alundra and all that, but she was just too unreliable. She was hard to do business with, and she had some personal problems that made her not exactly conducive to a business environment, to put it in a nutshell. You know, I don't want to, truthfully, I hate to, you know, throw dirt on her grave. You know what I mean? I just,
right.
You know, she had a lot of problems, and unfortunately, they escalated to the point where she took the unprecedented step of ending her own life. So I say, I salute. You know, I can only imagine what she might be going through, and I just hope and pray that the Lord Jesus Christ never gets me in that position where I feel that way, and I hope for none of us, and nobody listening or otherwise either, as far as that goes.
Did her, you know, her run with the title and then Alundra winning it back briefly, do you know why they decided to bury the division at that point and end it? Because it looked like they were bringing in some of the women from Japan and they were going to kind of rejuvenate things. And then all of a sudden the division, you know, closed down and Alundra, Medusa, Miceli left and went back to WCW, of course, the infamous throwing the garbage can in the, or throwing the title in the garbage can.
Right.
You know, what led to the women's division going down? Any idea?
Honestly, I have no idea. And truthfully, I don't run nothing in WWE but my mouth, so I never have, so I don't know. You know, and this is going to sound sarcastic, but it's actually the truth. They don't consult me when they make decisions, you know, so I don't know. I don't know. And I hadn't even really thought about it. And truthfully, I never paid attention that the women's division,
right.
Or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if you call it division, just, you know,
right,
but,
yeah.
Either way, I hear a lot of times, like, if you go on the internet or whatever, they talk about a tag team division. What division? There's a division? You know what I mean? Let's face it. It's not the NFL or AFC East and West or whatever, you know. So,
right.
Hell, I don't know. But I really don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I've never been one to really concentrate on too many of those things.
Now, Bruno, obviously at this time in late 1995, you know, WCW started Monday Nitro. What was the tone of the company? How were things around backstage and just the company in general when Nitro started and the Monday Night Wars, if you will, began? What were things like when it turned out the WCW was going to compete directly with Raw on Monday nights?
Well, you know, I guess everybody was wondering who's going to try to jump ship or whatever, because apparently they were, you know, throwing out money left and right. I guess it had a lot to do with a lot of guys getting guaranteed contracts to stay. Or to go to the other place, I would assume. Me, I was, you know, I was under my certain situation, which I still am, but I'm very happy with it. I never even entertained the thought of leaving WWE because, after all, it's been, you know, very good to me, and I wouldn't turn my back on the organization ever. A lot of guys didn't see it that way, evidently. I guess the, you know, deep pockets of the other side had a lot to do with a lot of guys jumping ship. But, you know, it's funny, those of us that were loyal to the company are still with the company, you know, and those
right.
that weren't, well, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. Some came and went, some didn't, some had no choice. But, you know, it was interesting to see who's going to jump next or whatever, and just I shook my head a lot of times, and I, you know, after guys like Luger, who Vince wrapped the whole company around in 1994, I think it was, and he turned around and was basically one of the first ones to jump. So,
yep.
And I like Luger, and I get along good with him. He's changed 180 degrees from the cocky narcissist, which was not only just his gimmick, but in real life. And he'll probably tell this himself. He was a narcissist, you know, at that time. But he found Jesus, and he, you know, he didn't curse Jesus for his physical problems that came along. He embraced, you know, Christ, and he became a much better person, and which just accentuates the story that the Lord works in strange and mysterious ways. But you know, I'm God bless Luger now, and I consider him a great guy and a friend, but at that time he was I thought he was very disloyal. I thought it was terrible what he did at that time.
What was the feeling within, you know, the company when everyone else started to jump as 96 dawned and, you know, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall bolted and then, you know, they formed the NWO over there. Was it really the sense, because, you know, the word around the rumor mill and everywhere else, and it was always that, you know, WWF was really close to going out of business in 96 to 97, and Vince, you know, was able to turn things around. But what was the feeling backstage? Did it kind of unite everyone and bring everyone together, or was it really a sense of, oh man, we could really be closing up shop and being out of jobs and all have to go work for Ted Turner? You know, what was the feeling of that backstage?
I guess I wasn't in a high enough position in the company to be part of those conversations, if in fact they did exist, you know, but, which I can't say, because I was just, you know, I was just making my check. I was doing whatever I was asked and told, and I just kept doing it. I knew I wasn't one of the high paid, you know, right, guys on the totem pole. So,
well, how about
even
like in the locker room? You know, like, what was the word going across, you know, all the guys in the locker room? Did they ever feel the sense of urgency that, man, we could, you know, something bad could happen here? Or,
well, again, like I say, if so, I wasn't privy to any of those conversations. I never heard that. I'm not going to sit here and sell anybody's intelligence, yep, and say that never happened, because it sounds very plausible. But I personally, I didn't hear it. You know, I'm a company man, so I guess nobody was going to come to me with anything like that anyway around me. And I never felt that way. I mean, if in fact that was the case, which I don't know, I'm just glad I rode the wave. You know, but I honestly, I can't lie. I've never heard that, but I've never been one. You know, I hate the word politics in the business. Everybody talks about politics. You have to have politics with this guy or there's politics. Nah, bullshit. I don't play on that. I just do my job and do what I'm asked, do what I'm told, and move on to the next town. And everybody that talks all that shit, well, that's on them. But I was never one to be involved in that. And maybe that's why that I don't know about that feeling, if it existed, because I was never one to get involved in any of that kind of talk and that kind of crap. You know, I honestly never have been. And still to this day, I'm not.
So after your managing, after Bertha Faye left the company, you kind of switched roles. You were off TV for a little bit, and then you came back in the spring. You hopped onto Superstars, which of course is, if you've been a wrestling fan for as long as JR and I have, Superstar, you hear the word Superstars and you think of fond memories of your childhood. And you started to critique the referees in the WWF, and you were reporting to President Gorilla Monsoon, another icon of us. Of us wrestling fans, and eventually he made you a ref. How did that scenario come about, starting to with the referees and then becoming a ref?
Well, that was just a way to switch me from the you know, little devious villain manager to a referee. We could just me walk out one day and I was a referee. It wouldn't make sense because I was switching into becoming a referee in the company, and which I did for, you know, around a year. And that was just a way to segue into that side of my career or whatever, but by that point I was just getting older and slower, and I wasn't able to move like I used to, so it was getting a little bit hard for me to referee. And there was some situations where a guy named Steve Taylor, that used to be with the company at that time, you were getting paid according to your booking instead of a weekly salary, at least on my situation, and he would book Billy Silverman, he would book people that he liked instead of just being fair, and I wasn't getting enough work, and I wasn't making enough money refereeing, you know, just once or twice a week. You can't live like that, and it just wasn't working out right. And I segued into the position I'm in now, and which I've been in for many years now. I'm very happy with it, but yeah, Steve Taylor is no longer with the WWE, and Billy Silverman is no longer with the WWE. Two people that one guy screwed the company and jumped to the WCW, the other one just because he was more self-centered and not considering enough about business, considering enough about himself, no longer with the company, and basically he was going to starve me out, and I wasn't going to have that. You know, it wasn't fair to me, and I wasn't, you know, wasn't WWE's fault. It wasn't Vince's fault by any means. Because when I went to Vince about the situation, Vince, we're having the matches right here in Memphis, and Steve Taylor's flying Billy Silverman in from Portland, Maine, when I live 9 miles from the arena. You know, that just wasn't fair. But at that point in time in the WWE, Steve Taylor and a girl named Carolyn Colford thought they ran the whole company. They thought their word was above even Vince's. Well, they found out that wasn't the case because they're not there. And I don't know where they are. Well, Steve Taylor works for Madison Square Garden now. I always speak nicely to him there when I see him. I have no hatred for him or anything. He's not Bruce Pritchard. But he didn't do business the right way, especially not just according to me, but according to a lot of people. He'd still be with WWE, obviously.
Shortly before that had happened, in late 95, Bill Watts actually came into WWF for a short run. I believe he booked a little bit. And what was his influence on the company? Because if you actually watch anything from that time period, it seemed like, you know, the matches got a little bit more realistic. The storylines did as well. And the product seemed to be turning a little bit after a rough year. Yeah, what, any stories from Bill Watts, or what were your thoughts of this short run there before he was kind of forced out?
Not really, because I never, other than saying hello, I never really even had very many conversations with him. And I don't think he was there long enough or had enough influence on anything. It might be just coincidental. I can't imagine he had much of an effect on the company in the short time he was there. I'm not saying he wouldn't have or couldn't have, but I really don't believe he did. That's just my outlook on it. At that time, I don't think he did. And, you know, he had a different style in his territory down in Louisiana, Oklahoma, and so forth than Memphis, which is the territory I came up in, and certainly different than WWE. A lot of the guys that he pushed and that, you know, he wanted to use on top, I don't think they could draw money other places. I could be wrong. Who am I to say? It's just my opinion. But, you know, a lot of those guys, I mean, Junkyard Dog is you know, a guy that was terrible in the ring, but he drew a lot of money. A lot of those guys that were amateur background or football, ex-football players or whatever, they were great athletes. They could probably whoop your ass, sure, but did they draw any money? And that's a million-dollar question.
At this point in 95 and into 96, there was the little group infamously known as the Click. Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, I guess 1-2-3 Kid, Sean Waltman, and eventually Triple H enter that fold. What was that like with them? What was it like working with Shawn? We'll talk about Shawn specifically. Working with Shawn in 95 during that stretch, and then 96 after Kevin and Scott left for WCW. Did you have a lot of workings with Shawn during that time? What was he like to work with in that two year stretch?
Well, I've known Shawn since 86, you know, and I've known him forever. And we've always got along great. He's treated me with great respect. Now, if he didn't like somebody or didn't like something, he was quick to let somebody know about it. That was his way. Me and him never had a problem. We never were in a situation where we would. But, you know, I remember, I don't know what year it was whatever the time was when I was managing Adam Baum. It was about the time I started segueing into the job I do now, going out and getting things for people, taking care of details and whatever. So one day I happened to be sent out for some reason. The catering wasn't any good, or they ran out of food or something. I don't remember what it was. We were either in Syracuse or Rochester. I can't remember. Upstate New York up there. And I went and got a bunch of hamburgers and brought them back. And I gave one to Razor, one to Sean, one to, you know, whoever else. And Oscar was in the grocery room. He says, "Hey, where's mine?" And I'll never forget it. This is unprompted or whatever. Shawn Michaels jumped up out of his chair in his dressing room and said, "Who the F are you to ask Bruno to give you anything? You don't ask him. No, he's been in the business 15 years. Who the hell do you think you are asking him for anything?" And he picked up Oscar and threw him out of the dressing room through the door and picked up his bag and threw it behind him. And then he went back and sat down. I was in shock. To this day, I'm in shock. And I appreciate that he actually, you know, he noticed. He remembered that he knew me since 1986. And that was like 97 or what. I don't know what the hell year it was. But, you know, he...
Right.
I appreciate that very much.
Of course, one of the infamous stories from around that time period was the issue in Syracuse with Shawn Michaels and the Marines, and all that went down led to him forfeiting the IC title. What's the truth behind that, Bruno? You know, you were involved. You know, you were there. Was that legit? Was it embellished? Was it something he did to drop the title? Or was it as, you know, brutal and, you know, out there as has been revealed?
Lord, I don't know. I know you and the listeners are about to think I'm full of shit, but I'm not. I really don't know. I think I probably mentioned this to y'all last time, but if I didn't, I stress it. I've always been one to shy away from the controversy because I don't want to be the one that knew. Because if it gets out, well, Bruno must have said it. Bruno knew about it. I've always been one to shy away from those things. I just come and do my job, do the best I can, don't offend anybody unless I, you know, just can't help it, and move on to the next town. That I don't know, and as far as the, I vaguely remember something about a fight with the Marines or something, I wasn't there for that, and hell, I just don't know. I never was going to go out to the nightclubs or bars or whatever afterwards. I stay, you know, away from everybody when I'm not at work. I see enough of them all day. I sort of want to spend the whole night with these people too, you know, no matter who they are. So, no, I really don't know. I mean, I hope this, you know, interview doesn't become boring. I was pretty wide open with this stuff back in the old days, but I really don't know about a lot of these things because I shy away from all that type of thing. I'm just not real social with the guys. You know, after things are over or whatever, I stay away.
All right, so as you progressed in 96 with the refereeing, and then early 97, you were actually tossed out of the ring by China, press slammed, actually.
Right.
That was the end of your refereeing career. After that, when did you start working? What were some of the duties you started gaining backstage? What were some of the things that you started to get in charge of, and maybe kind of sliding off screen?
Well, for a while, I was in charge of getting a lot of the pre-tape interviews done backstage. You know, getting guys in the room to do the inserts. Remember, it used to be like there'd be a match in the ring, they'd cut to like a little box in the corner, and like
one of
the competitors. Yeah, I was in charge of getting those guys in the room to make those little interviews, those little statements, and so forth. That was one of my first responsibilities. And then things started coming up. Well, this guy needs his rental car returned. There's nobody to do it. Well, this guy needs, you know, his suitcase picked up at the airport where the airlines, you know, lost it. But it came in now. There's nobody to get it. Before you know it, I started volunteering. And then, lo and behold, the pre-tape job went to my good friend Steve Lombardi, who was another guy in my position who was, you know, in the ring for many years and then, you know, was segueing out of that. So that worked out well for him. I like getting out and doing stuff and having assignments and responsibilities and a list of things to take care of. And then, you know, after that, I became all around concierge, whatever. So, you know, one of the top guys needs to, you know, for example, I'm just using this, making this up. But like, if they say, well, Shawn Michaels, they want him to wear a fireman's outfit today or whatever, I'd be the one to go out and try to find a supply house that, you know, has fire hats and fireman, you know, outfits, you know, whatever. I do a lot of that type of thing. Just last minute details they need for the show. We need a metal trash can to tie on a pole for the guys to climb up and try to get. I'll go get the metal trash can. And just, you know, things like that. It goes from the boring of return or rent a car or maybe go get a few steaks for some of the top guys or some of the executives, or it might be, you know, go get the metal trash can, or, you know, we need a live duck, you know, we open the dressing room door and a duck flies out or whatever. There's other guys that do stuff too that work for the props department, but basically, you know, a lot of that is what I do.
And that's a pretty cool gig, because, you know, I always kind of wonder, we're all, you know, who's in charge of getting all these crazy things. So it's pretty neat that's kind of what you fell into and found a good
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one. We got a fantastic guy named Ellis Edwards that does a lot of things behind the scenes. We've got a big guy named Tom that does a lot of things, and Nick Daw, and they've got some guys underneath them, Andy and Anthony and Mark Shillstone. They do a lot of that too. But they more concentrate on getting the things for the show, like if they needed a special trap door built or something, like Ellis and his crew do that. They're fantastic. I don't do nothing like that. But I might be the one that goes to Home Depot and buys the hinges for the trap door, you know, whatever. So
yep.
We all work together.
So I'm sorry, Scott, go ahead.
Well, this is just kind of a humorous question for you, Bruno. In the time you've been at WWE and doing and in this great role, how many ladders do you think you've bought in your day?
No, I never bought any of the ladders. I guess Ellison did that. I don't know. Never bought the ladders.
Just seems like an absorbent amount since 1994. So
I would say, yeah. But I ain't gonna lie. I never was the one to get the ladders.
It just seemed like so many.
Let me just lie. It was all me. And if it wasn't for me, none of the ladder matches would have taken place. Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon owe me. How about that? That would be the quote all over the internet.
That's good. And it came from our show. That's even the best part.
I mean, it's funny. We'll talk for an hour, and that'll be what they remember. Everybody, I was being sarcastic. I didn't mean it. Put that part in. It was a joke.
That's awesome, Bruno.
Moving all right. Scott, just to jump ahead. Moving in
from
96 to 97, Bruno, obviously we started to see the Attitude Era, and things started to change. the old school way of doing things, where you know they tried to draw fans to the house shows more than focusing really on TV ratings and pay per view buys. But is the Attitude Era and Vince Russo came into be, and the shift happened with Steve Austin becoming big. What did you think of the time as it was happening? Did you think this was just gonna be a fad? Did you think it was really something that was gonna help launch the company? And did you enjoy it? Did you like that turn in the product, or were you more of a fan, coming up through the territory system? Were you more of a fan of the old school way of booking the promotion?
Well, no, I've always been a fan of whatever fills up the audience, to bring the ratings, and to put the ass every 32 inches or whatever the hell the saying is, get to fill up the arena. That's what I'm a fan of. Stone Cold and me are very close friends. So just him alone, getting that successful, which I always knew he could, had the potential to do so, just needed the proper break. Being the ringmaster wasn't it,
No.
But Stone Cold was it. And that was great. And you got to give a lot of credit to Triple H and Shawn Michaels, DX, for that big turnaround, too. Stone Cold, The Rock, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, the DX situation, that little trifecta there, to me, is what turned the business around. I mean, all those guys, Stone Cold, Rock, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, and then everyone that came with them along for the tremendous roller coaster ride right there. But I tell you, that's the group right there. And DX, don't underestimate their role in, turning the company's fortunes back in our favor.
Talking about Stone Cold, JR and Bruno. Obviously, he was on such a roll, and we're coming up on our vintage vaults. We're coming up on SummerSlam 97. Saying you were so close to him, obviously that was the night that he suffered the neck injury on the Owen Hart pile driver at the Meadowlands. Were you backstage that night? What was it? What was it like when he came? When he got in the back? If you liked him, if you want to talk about it, what was it like when he came in the back? How was the sense? What was the sense of urgency? How was that whole scenario?
Oh boy, you got me painted into a corner now. I don't want to make it a lie.
No, it's okay.
I don't remember. I don't know. I might have been in a parking lot. I might have been sitting somewhere else. I don't know. I don't remember. I really and truly don't remember.
Okay, no problem. Just thought I'd throw it out there.
Yeah, don't mind. I mean, it's just like being in the court of law. I don't recall. I plead the fifth. I really don't remember.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're gonna push you a little bit more now.
I'll keep not remembering. Right. In certain situations, I ain't going to lie to you.
All right. Two months later, the infamous Montreal incident happened with Bret Hart. He was released from his contract, and then the infamous Montreal screw job. Any recollections of that night? And you don't have to tell us any behind-the-scenes stuff or anything. But
let me tell you, this is God's honest truth. I was not there when that happened. I was at the show that night, but we were going to be in Ottawa the next day. And that was when Butterbean came in, along with his manager, a guy named Art Dore. They were flying into Ottawa.
Right.
And Jim Ross had asked me to pick up Butterbean and Art Dore when they landed in Ottawa and bring them to the hotel and the whole bit, which I was happy to do. And Butterbean turned out to be a really great guy, and Art Dore was a nice guy, too. But I had to leave Montreal. It was like 150 miles, give or take. Which is funny, that's the same trip we're going to be making this week for Raw and SmackDown, but that's beside the point. I had to leave early in order to be in Ottawa on time to pick up Art Dorn and Eric Esch, Butterbean. So I wasn't there. I was not there. I had left already.
What was the atmosphere like backstage on the TV the following week? Because, of course, infamously, a lot of guys threatened to quit or quit, and that first couple of Raws right after was a very thin roster. Was it a kind of a dark feeling backstage? Was it a lot of angst and anger before egos finally cooled and everyone realized we can't risk our jobs for Bret? He's fine. What was it like those first couple of weeks following it?
That pretty much what you just said. A lot of guys were talking a lot of shit about it and everything. And me, I did like I was telling you all a while ago. I just kept doing my job. Bret's a good friend of mine. A dear friend of mine. I mean, I love Bret. I can't wait to see him this week. And if he called me up right now and said he wanted to come down and live with me for 6 months, I would let him live with me and my wife for 6 months. I'd let him stay the rest of his life if he wanted to. I'm crazy about him. His lovely wife is a great girl. So it's nothing against Bret or anything. But when it comes to this, why did he lose the championship? Was it right he did it? Should he have did this? And I don't even want to get into the, whys and wherefores of behind the scenes of people winning and losing championships or whatever. That's not what I'm here for, is to be an expose or an attempted expose of anything that goes on. But I just, personally, I didn't care. I did not care. I mean, if the company you work for asks you to do something, you do it. I don't give a damn if it's WWE. I don't give a damn if it's Midas Muffler or McDonald's. When the guy that's paying you asks you to do something, that's what you're supposed to do. So, you know, that was just my take on it. But, I mean, hey, whatever. But, and WWE worked out, and they're back on good terms now. I say I salute once again. God bless everybody involved. Me, I didn't care. I just wanted to continue to take care of me and my family.
Okay. So now one of the more, and this is a personal question asked of one of our listeners. Where did the idea to become Hervina and actually win your first championship come about?
Well, it's funny. It was my idea, but it got bastardized. I just wanted to go out and have a regular match in the ring and become the ladies' champion. That was my idea. Endeavor to become the ladies' champion, at least, I should say. I presented the idea. By the time it came back to me, you know, you ever when we were kids, that game, telephone in school, there'd be 10 of us, and I'd whisper something in your ear, and you'd whisper it to the next guy, and he'd whisper it to the next guy. By the time it got to the last guy, the story was completely different. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what happened there. Before you know it, I was in a kiddie pool full of real snow that was picked up outside of the arena, and I was wearing a dress, or not a dress, but like a women's ski bunny outfit or whatever, and a wig, and I was clean shaven, had lipstick on, a rouge and makeup.
You look great.
I look great. Well, that speaks volumes about the rumors I've heard about you. I'm only kidding.
you'd have to be dressed like Triple H to really make that work.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I'm really getting concerned. But anyway. that's how that came about. It was my idea, but by the time it came to its fruition, it wasn't my idea no more, but it was too late to turn back, so I just had to go for it. And I can honestly say I take no pride in the fact that I probably had the worst match in the history of Monday Night Raw.
There are probably others. I wouldn't sell yourself that short. there's probably been some others that were a lot worse.
Well, that's true, because Bruce Pritchard as Brother Love was probably involved in a match or two, so you're right. Anything he's involved in. You know how some people have the Midas touch, anything they touch turns to gold? Well, Bruce Pritchard has manure touch. Anything he touches turns to shit. So.
I guess the next best thing would be if Eric Embry was on Raw, and then things would really go out of
control.
Things are really
my God. Well, let me tell you something. Honestly, God, I got to say this. I have to say this. Eric Embry, in the ring, he had a terrible look. He wasn't, you know, didn't have a great body or nothing. As bad as I hate to say it, with his booking and his attitude and the way he behaved, you know, behind the scenes or whatever, I have to say that he was not a bad worker. He was not bad in the ring. His stuff looked good. You know, he was a good, you know, he's a good hand in the ring. I will not take that away from him. I cannot lie, use personal feelings to you know, tarnish the fact that he was a good worker, which is more than I can say for Bruce Pritchard, who is the worst ever at anything, period, when it came to, I mean, as an athlete, Bruce Pritchard had two left feet, had two right shoes on. I mean, he was a piece of crap. From A to Z. At least Eric Embry had that redeeming value that he was an evil heel on the microphone when he was a heel, and he could, you know, really get the people against him, and he was decent in the ring. And the deal he did in Texas when he took World Class and turned it into USWA, you know, as part of the storyline or whatever, and he, you know, they ripped the banner down and the whole bit. That was emotional. He did a great job there. And you know, he should have stayed there instead of come to Memphis where he didn't fit in. And I'm saying that with all candor, not just out of personal feeling. He did a great job. I just hate that he came to Memphis and, you know, became such an a-hole.
So you're not a fan of Brother Love?
Well, Brother Love's great. What are you kidding?
All right. All right, Bruno. of all the people you've managed throughout time, who was the favorite person you managed and who was your least favorite?
Well, my least favorite was Bert DeFay, without a doubt. And, I hate to say it, but, we have to be we're under the honesty tree here. Now, as far as my most favorite, are you talking about WWE? Or are you talking about all through my life in the business?
All time.
Well, there was a guy, probably 98% of the listeners won't remember because it was back in the Memphis Territory days, but a guy named Phil Hickerson, who was the first champion I ever managed, the Southern Heavyweight Champion, and he was a great guy and a heck of a talent in the ring. Didn't have the body of nowadays guys. He was a big, barrel-chested, tough, rough, raw bone, type of guy. He was just very believable in the ring. I mean, he did look like he could kill you. And just looking at him looked like he could kill you. Like, looked like a guy that, was just a bouncer at a beer joint or whatever. So, we were great friends. I mean, I stayed at his house. He stayed at mine. We had a good time together. I mean, he was a great guy. He was probably the most favorite guy I ever managed. On another note, there were only on one occasion that I managed either one of these guys, so I'm not going to sit here and say I was their manager, I was this, I was that. I wasn't. But one night in Jonesboro, Arkansas, I managed Stone Cold Steve Austin when he was stunning Steve Austin when he was in the Memphis Territory. Just one night, because J.C. Ice was his normal manager, but for some reason J.C. couldn't be on the show that night. They needed somebody to come out and manage, so I managed him that one night. And, I'm very proud of that, I did the same thing one night in Memphis. I managed Mean Mark Callis for one night, and it's on YouTube. You can watch me managing him against Superstar Bill Dundee, which I'm very proud of that. So I managed two of the top guys in the history of the business. Only on one occasion, but still I can say I did it. It's a little feather in my hat.
All right, let me ask you this, Bruno. I'm going to put you kind of in the booking chair. If you could take one guy from the 80s, 90s, and this decade, in their peak, and you're starting a whole new promotion, who are you taking?
In other words, we're forgetting that this guy might be 65 years old now. We're acting like he's at his peak right now. Magic time machine.
Right, so someone in their peak in the 80s when you were around, someone in their peak in the 90s, and then the 2000s. Who are you drafting?
All right, if I can get anybody I wanted, living or dead. I would want Don Morocco. He was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He was a tremendous talker. He had a great look. He was unbelievable in the ring. In fact, I always regretted that he never came to Memphis because I wanted to manage him against Lawler, which I think would have been tremendous matches. I think it would have been record business. So with that being said, obviously, I want Lawler in the top of the card. I want Morocco, who I think is incredible. I think my dear friend Steve Lombardi, who is a very good, underrated talent in the ring, he can do anything, asked of him. He's a great support guy on the card. I would have him on the card. I'm going to get away from the Rock, Stone Cold, Shawn Michaels thing, because that's what everybody would say.
Right.
So that's obvious. That's obvious.
No, of course.
So I'll put that aside. Shoot, there was guys that were like really, really good, but never went, to the top of the ladder in the business that were really good. Pat Tanaka was a tremendous talent.
Yeah.
I managed him in Memphis, and I managed against him when he was babyface in Memphis. I think Pat Tanaka was fantastic. Robert Fuller, one of the best talkers ever in the business. His partner, who I managed, Robert and Jimmy. Jimmy Golden, tremendous. What a worker. Look up Jimmy Golden. A lot of people might remember him as Bunkhouse Buck when he went to WCW.
Oh, yeah.
He's tremendous. I would put him on the card in a heartbeat.
Yeah, he's definitely someone that's kind of slipped through the cracks. But, yeah, you were right. He was great even in that role in WCW. And, of course, Jack Swagger's father a couple years ago.
Right. Absolutely. And, again, like I said, I'm staying away from the obvious picks, because, it was already done with Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan, of course. So I'm going to pick the ones that might, maybe didn't get that opportunity. All right, so looking back again, this is a great question. Superstar Bill Dundee, I'd bring him in as a manager because he could talk his butt off, I would be in there as a manager because I could talk my butt off. I mean, he would be the Yeah, there was like the old time wrestler. He became a manager, and then there was a little bitty manager. So that was me and him would be the two managers on the card, you know, or what have you, on the organization. Of course, there's a lot of guys that never got their break anywhere but around Memphis that I would have. Billy Travis was a heck of a talent. I would have used him. If, you know, God rest his soul, he's dead. Boy, I tell you, Hickerson, the guy I was telling you about, I mean, people never seen a guy like him on a national or worldwide level. It would be different, but I think it would work. You know, we'd have to come up with a hell of a gimmick for him, because the deal we had for him here in Memphis was great for this area. It might not work in Seattle, Washington, or you know, Los Angeles, California. We'd have to come up with a suitable gimmick to get him all over the place. But him, Dutch Mantel, I would use in a heartbeat. Oh, my God, there's so many. There's a lot of guys that really could draw money. Hustler Rip Rogers. And I tell you, the best tag team that I ever managed in my life, two of the greatest guys I ever managed, two of the greatest guys I ever traveled with, worked with, lived with, is the Batten Twins. I don't know if y'all remember them. They were fantastic guys.
I don't know if I know their names. I do. Two guys that you said that really stuck out for me. One is the Magnificent Morocco, because he was, as a kid, he was the first heel I ever saw.
Was
Morocco. The feud between him and Jimmy Snuka was the feud that made me a wrestling fan. And obviously the match
tremendous.
Of the guard. Yeah, he was
tremendous.
Awesome. I agree with you. I think he would have been awesome in Memphis. I mean, he would have gotten those Mid-South Coliseum fans incredibly pissed off that I think they would have wanted his hide. So I agree with you about Morocco. I also agree with you about Dutch Mantel, too. I was a big fan of Dirty Dutch.
Well, let me say this to y'all right now. Off the subject completely, but I think it's very important to mention this. Did y'all hear what happened to Dutch's family this past week?
No.
No.
Okay, this is very big, because I've talked to Dutch many times over this, and maybe I can get you to, you know, put the word out a little bit. His beautiful 16-year-old granddaughter, Amelia, was killed by a speeding ex-convict on parole drunk driver.
Oh, God. That's terrible.
No, it's unbelievable. She was on her way to cheerleading practice at her school there in Maryville, Tennessee, which is up outside of Knoxville. She forgot her pom-poms. She went home to get her pom-poms, and this drunk driver that was running from the police at the time, because he was on parole, and he was on drugs and drunk, was speeding, smashed into her head-on and killed her.
Oh.
And it's just a tragic, unbelievable. It's killing Dutch, and it's killing me, because I'm a friend with him for like 30 years. Let me just throw this out to people. Dutch Mantel would like anybody to follow him on Facebook for updates on what you can do to help change the law about three-strike offenders being out there driving and in the streets. And Dutch says anybody that would like to help or would like some more information on the subject or just to pass their condolences, to drop him an email at Dirty Dutch Mantel with two L's. Dirty Dutch Mantel, MANTELL, at gmail.com. He asked me to pass that on when he knew I was going to be on the show tonight. So again, I'll say it's Dirty Dutch Mantel, that's with two L's, at gmail.com. Anybody that could, just offer some support in any kind of way, even if it's just to create awareness in your community or, you know, help Dutch, distribute information or whatever about the matter of keeping these, you know, killers off the road, killing beautiful, innocent 16-year-old, you know, girls. I mean, it could be anybody's mother, brother, son, daughter, or anybody themselves. Next, if something isn't done about that, and, I'm throwing my hat in the ring on that one. I want to help any way I can as well.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll most definitely do that. We'll do that on our page,
doubt.
And that's terrible. Oh, well, we'll say a prayer for him and his family and definitely help out with that. So it's Dirty Dutch Mantel, two L's, at gmail.com. And,
Very good. That's great.
And we'll hop on his Facebook page as well. We tell him we're two fans of his, and we'll definitely get the word out. No doubt about it.
And I tell you what, Dutch would probably love to be on y'all's show, this show right here. And, if you would, if you drop an email, let him know that y'all are the guys that are buddies with me, and I did this show with you, and that We'd love to have him on here. I bet you he would love to talk wrestling and obviously talk about his crusade now as well. I think that he might be a hell of a guest for y'all sometime in the future.
Oh, without a doubt. Yes. Definitely have him on. We're definitely going to work on that. Thank you, Bruno. Definitely.
Sure. But back to the less important but more entertaining wrestling. Continue, please.
No, we're glad you did. We're glad you said something, Bruno. We're definitely glad you said something, and we're definitely going to get the word out. We'd definitely love to have Dutch on. Number one, because we want to get this message out, because it's just terrible. Absolutely terrible. And secondly, of course, obviously less important than that, we'd love to hear about his career, because he was one of my favorites as a kid throughout all the promotions. I thought I remember seeing him in World Class when I was a kid, and obviously saw him in other promotions as well. So.
Well, let me tell you, there's some funny stories now. I'll try to shift away from the terrible, tragic stories. I think we're painting the picture there. But look, the funny stories is years ago, we were out in Panama City, Florida, for the Continental Territory. Dutch and me and Sid, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, Danny Davis, Ken Wayne, Dirty White Boy, Eddie Gilbert, I mean, the whole crew. So back then, we'd be out after the show, we'd all go to the beach and, have some, barbecue and some beer and drinks by the water and everything. And then we'd all go make our way back to the hotel and hang out or whatever and then go to bed. So now, bear in mind, I wasn't driving, so I can, I'll be honest about this. But I was pretty drunk. This is back in like 1985 or 84, something like that. I was pretty drunk. So I got back in the hotel room, and Dutch was in one bed, and Dirty White Boy was in the other bed, and I slept on the floor because I was just drunk. I had to sleep somewhere. And Sid had the key to our room. And he was off at the beach. He was a big athlete running through the waves or whatever. I wanted to go to bed. I was drunk. So the next day, Sid was trying to find me. He finally found me in Dutch and him's room. And I take it back. It was Tom Pritchard, not Dirty White Boy. But anyway, Sid says, Dutch, where's Bruno? And he says, over here, I think. And Sid said, look, those, Bruno, why didn't you come back to the room? I said, I didn't know what room it was. I said, and Dutch made me sleep on the floor.
Oh, God.
So, to this day, like, if you have Dutch on the radio show, after you get him, in a better frame of mind, mention the time he made me sleep on the floor, which he didn't. I was drunk, wasn't the floor. But I looked up at Sid and he made me sleep on the floor. And Sid was real mean to Dutch for about a week after that. And there was no truth to it. Nobody made me sleep on the floor.
That's funny.
That's funny. All right, Bruno. Before we wrap up, and again, you've been awesome. We're gonna throw some personalities at you throughout your career, and just give us a few words on each of them in terms of their personality, how they were in the ring, how they were to work with throughout your whole career. We're just gonna throw guys at you, managers, wrestlers, anybody that comes to mind, just to give the fans an insight on these guys. All right.
I'll do it, and I want all the fans and the listeners. And even y'all, to bear in mind, I don't have any idea what names you're going to throw at me. This has been pre-discussed.
Nope.
And anything I say is strictly my opinion. So
right.
You know what I mean? So
yep.
I want to make sure everybody knows. If I say, so-and-so is a no-good so-and-so, well, that's my opinion. That might not be true. That's just how I perceive
Absolutely.
It. So with that clarified, let's go for it.
Okay. Number one, the Ultimate Warrior.
I don't got along with it. I mean, I had no beef with him. He was always nice to me, and, he drew money. He was the spectacle to look at. He wasn't the greatest performer in the ring, but people paid to see him, and he was what he was. They weren't expecting to see Shawn Michaels or Chris Jericho when he got in the ring. They were expecting to see what he did, so they got what they paid for.
Rick Rude.
I was like Rick Rude. I mean, you know what? He looked good. He was a good guy. I got along good with him. I've heard stories about him to the negative, but I've never experienced that personally, so I can't say a bad word about him.
Owen Hart.
Owen Hart.
I get along good with Owen Hart. He was a great guy. I mean, shoot, he was funny. He was intelligent. He was good in the ring. And we used to ride together sometimes, and he used to crack my back. He was the best backcracker in a bit. If he'd give me like the backslide, the deal was his back was against my back, he'd lean forward and pull me back and pop my back from the the bottom of my spine to the top. He did this for me on a regular basis without complaint. And it was a tragic what happened to Owen. It was a tragic accident. He was a hell of a guy. And I said, God bless him.
Were his ribs as legendary as the word is about him?
Oh, yeah. He was good about pulling pranks. But nothing mean-spirited. He wouldn't set your clothes on fire. You know, he wouldn't do nothing like that. He was a good guy.
Either the warlord or the barbarian or both. Powers of Pain.
Oh, yeah. I got one. Great. Yeah, I managed Warlord when he was in WWE. And he's a good guy. Barbarian, too. I mean, they never did anything, period, negative towards me. Nice guys, big guys. And, they were, if they would have came around before the Road Warriors, they may have been the premier team of that area. They just happened to come along afterward.
Dynamite Kid.
Never met him.
Gary Young. I know that's a weird one, but I was a big World Class watcher, and he was...
That's okay. Gary Young was a prick. You know? He really was. He really was. I don't hate him. I don't even dislike him. But he was a prick. He's the type of guy right now. If he showed up at my house and came in, and I said, hey, Gary, I'm doing a radio thing right now. Go in there and, get what you want out of the icebox and just, chill out until I get through. I'd go in there and probably have my TV cable unhooked and probably hide my wallet, and he'd, unplug my refrigerator, all my meat would be ruined. You know what I mean? He's just like, he was that type of guy. He was always effing with somebody, and it backfired on him. We was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee one night. It was a tag team match. Now, here's the deal. In the spot shows in the Memphis territory, sometimes they would have two towns a night. So they'd have half the crew in one town and half the crew in another town. So they would have everybody would work twice, whether it was a tag match later in the card after everybody worked a single match, or maybe a battle royal or whatever. So, and also, too, in the old days, the dress rooms were separate most of the time, especially in the spot show towns. All the bad guys were on one side of the arena, and all the good guys were on the other side of the arena. They never was together, and that's the truth. I'm not just saying that for the fans, it's the truth. And the referee or the promoter or somebody would go back and forth to carry messages or what have you. So the opening match was Gary Young against Scott Steiner. So after that match, something went wrong in the match or whatever, I don't know. And Gary Young told Frank Morrell, the referee, to go over to the other side and say, tell Scott Steiner he better learn how to work. Well, later on that night, the match was Gary Young and Don Bass against Scott Steiner. And I think Billy Travis, I'm not sure. But anyway, Scott Steiner sent word back to Gary Young, you better learn how to shoot. And they got in the ring, and Scott Steiner tied him up like a friggin' pretzel. He was turning shades of colors I've never seen on a human being. And Gary Young was reaching for the ropes, tapping out, whatever. That don't work when it's real, you know. And I swear to God, I believe Scott Steiner would have killed him. I knew he could have. There's no doubt in my mind. I was out there managing, and I said, oh, come on, Scott, don't kill him. And, Gary Young, it broke him from sucking eggs right there. You got to watch who you're messing at, around with. There's ways to handle things. And that's a Gary Young story. He's the guy that did a lot of picky things. One day I was asleep in a rocking chair over at Tommy Lane's apartment in Nashville. Y'all might not remember Tommy Lane, but he was one of the rock and roll RPMs years ago. So Gary Young thought it would be a good idea. He handcuffed me to the rocking chair when I was asleep. I mean, that's, all right, let me out. And he pretended he couldn't find the key, the whole bit, and just, he used to do stuff like that, And it ain't good. I'm not in favor of ribs. Like, Owen's ribs were, funny. He'd squirt you with a squirt gun when you walk by, and he'd pretend like it wasn't him, and you'd look around, and, stuff like that. Funny. Gary Young's were hurtful and mean, and I don't believe in that, so,
Kind of along the thread of the Scott Steiner story, who were the real tough guys as far as, if something happened, if something, broke down in the ring, or even, you're out at a bar and, a fight's about to break out, with some guy thinks he's, some meathead thinks he can take everyone out. Who are the real legit, always hear about guys like Haku and, Rick Rude. Who are the real tough guys in wrestling history that you ran across? Just a few.
Okay, sure. Well, you named two of them right there, Haku, Rick Rude. Phil Hickerson, the guy I talked to you about a while ago, he was a badass. Rhodey, Brian Armstrong, he's a badass. Sid's a badass. Bam Bam Bigelow is a badass. Oh, there's more. Now, the thing about the Rick Rude thing, let me say this. And Kurt Hennig used to laugh about this, but I didn't think it was good. That Rick Rude would have his girlfriend come on to a guy at a bar. On purpose, the guy would go with it. She was good looking. And then Rude would come down and beat the guy up. And Kurt Hennig and them thought it was really funny. I didn't think so. The guy didn't do nothing wrong. She came on to him. I don't think it was funny to beat somebody up innocently. That I didn't like. I have to shoot straight. But he was a badass. Oh, my God, I got to think. Look, Kurt Angle, definitely a badass, without a doubt. I mean, there's quite a few of them. But, yeah, Bam Bam, tough son of a bitch.
Well, you're talking to two huge Bigelow fans right now, so that's
super
that's
guy.
Awesome.
Great guy.
Awesome, great guy.
Really. And I'm going to tell you something. A lot of people might laugh and think I'm, you know, just saying this, but I'm not. Dwayne Johnson is a tough son of a bitch.
I wouldn't mess with him.
No, I wouldn't either.
Know that much.
Yeah.
He is, that story, I don't know if you saw that story, Bruno. I'm sure that it's made the rounds, how he fended off a couple guys trying to break into the movie set last week and steal
some
stuff.
Yeah, I heard that. But that wasn't my basis for that, though. He's just really, you know, he's a tough son of a bitch. I'm going to tell another guy. Everybody says, oh, bullshit. It's not bullshit. It's the truth. Lawler, a guy came after him with a hammer one day in the parking lot of Channel 5. He took the hammer, snatched it away from the guy. I mean, imagine a guy coming at you with a hammer. I stood there and watched him do it. Took the hammer away from the guy.
Best punches in the business, Jerry Lawler? I think a lot of
undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Lawler, number one. Razor Ramon right up there.
Yeah, Razor Ramon, you're right. He always had great
Razors were good, yeah. All right, JR knew I was going to ask you this one. Well, he didn't, but he's not surprised. Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, he's a hell of a guy. Me and him get along great. We have a good time. Every time we're together, we laugh and cut up. And oh, super guy. I really, really like him. And he's easy as can be. He don't have to hardly do nothing. The people go nuts. I mean, he's a great guy. He's right up there with another super guy. Bobby Slaughter, Sergeant Slaughter, super guy.
I remember meeting him when I was a kid. Yeah, Slaughter was very cool.
What are your thoughts on Brian Pillman?
I always got along with him. You know, poor guy. He just had his demons. I guess the injuries and the various you know, health issues he had contributed to his sad and tragic early demise. But I liked him. He was always nice to me. You know, I got along real good with him.
How big do you think he could have been in the Attitude Era if he had survived?
I don't know. He wasn't exactly. If you remember, they're still mostly big guys then.
Right.
So I don't know. I can't say.
Interesting.
Tell me some more names. I love it. That's fun, really.
here's a guy that I know you worked with throughout the promotions. I don't know if you were both in Memphis at the same time, but a guy that we lost way too soon, and a guy we wish we could have seen, you know, at least a few more times, and that's Randy Savage. What was he like? Even before WWF, I know we might have talked about it briefly in the last part. When he was coming up in Memphis, what just in general in your time with him, what was he like?
Oh, I thought Randy Savage was a great guy. I mean, I always got along with him. Always. I mean, smooth as can be, smooth as glass in the ring. And, you know, when he got the opportunity to go to WWE, the first thing he did was made sure he did business right, and he finished out his commitments in Memphis before he left. He wasn't going to just jump up and run. He did everything he was supposed to do. He was a complete businessman. And, man, I really liked him. I always got along good with him. And he never, ever took advantage of me in the ring. And I've been in many situations with him in the ring. Never took advantage of me. Super guy.
How about Yokozuna? A guy I don't think gets enough credit from fans as being just a great heel champion.
Oh, yeah, he was great. You know what? I was in Louisiana with him right before I went to WWE. I was in Louisiana with him in 88. It was after Bill Watts was no longer the promoter there. I was working for IWF, I think it was called then. He was known as the Great Kikino in
yes.
there.
Yeah, right, and, yep.
Yeah, I managed him in there. And good guy. Good guy in the ring, smooth. definitely there was money written all over him. I always knew. He's one of the few guys, him, Sid, Stone Cold, Rock, one of the few guys, when I seen them the first time, I seen they're going to go all the way. And it's true. You know, I really mean that. I'm not going back and saying that because it happened. Because there's been some guys I said that about that didn't go even a quarter of the way. So, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, he's a heck of a guy. I really liked him, and I miss him.
Another guy, Bruno, that I remember reading about when I was younger. My brother was a big fan of his. But another guy who seemed like he had his demons, but was a great character, was Eddie Gilbert. What was he like?
Very, very committed to the business. Very, very intense. Had a severe temper, bad temper. And I've had the brunt of it on several occasions. Sometimes deservedly, sometimes. Not so much, but very, very good friend of mine. So, I mean, sometimes you can have, falling outs with a good friend. Doesn't mean that you hate them and they're putting them down. You know, we had our little falling outs. But in general, he was a real student of the business, a walking encyclopedia of the business, and just a real, really good guy whose biggest mistake he ever made was Missy Hyatt. Well, I put up there the female Bruce Pritchard.
Yes.
Really?
I think many would.
Yeah, probably.
Yes.
What, and I guess along those lines, as far as talking about women in the business, someone who kind of relaunched what a women's persona was in the WWF, and that's Sunny in 1996, kind of came out of nowhere and really became the first diva. And, people my age, of course, grew up with her right through their adolescence. And I know there were many Sunny posters on the wall. What was she like at the time backstage and your impressions of her?
Well,
very
funny
influential.
Thing. The first time I met her is when Candido came to Memphis the first time. I was in charge of the rings in Memphis. So him and her just came down from Jersey or Philly or wherever they was at. And they showed up at the arena like at noon or whatever. They didn't have nowhere to go. They just got there, And me and my crew were setting up the ring. And they come in, and here him and her, I had no idea who he was, because nobody told me, Even back then, I was not privy to the inner workings of the company. Nobody told me there's a new guy coming in, or whatever. So him and her come in. She wasn't a manager, a valet, nothing. She was just his girlfriend with him. We're looking for Jerry Lawler. I said, well, it's only noon. He won't be here till 7 o'clock at night. And, I was all dirty and greasy and, working on the ring. And they said, where's the hotel we can go to? And I'd give them directions to a hotel. I said, let them know you're with the USWA and you'll get the USWA rates and so on and so forth. They were, real nice to me and everything. And like, after they left Memphis, I never seen them no more for a while until he got his run in Smoky Mountain or whatever. And I said, oh, my God, that girl that's managing out there. Tammy Sitch, that's the one that was with him in Memphis. And then, before you know it, she was, like you said, the original diva or whatever. I have no issues. I've seen her having some meltdowns, but hopefully that's all past her now. I like her.
You think Candido was wasted in his run with WWF, or do you think that, that was going to be the furthest he'd get anyway?
I think it was about the furthest he'd get anyway. I mean, which is not a knock or an insult or a slap in any way. That was his position. They put him with that loser Spicoli for a little while. I mean, God bless him for being dead, but you know what? It was inadvertent suicide. He was a goof, Spicoli. Let the emails ring out, but I just insulted the dead great Spicoli. He was a goof. Let me rephrase that. He was a goof. He was a follower. He thought he was going to impress people by taking massive quantities of drugs, and he's dead. Can I say that any more clearly? Spicoli was a goof.
It's unfortunate, too.
I don't wish him dead. I'm not saying that, but his death was his own doing.
Oh, right. Definitely.
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. Well, all those guys in that era, unfortunately, they had demons, couldn't control them, and unfortunately, everyone knew what the result was likely going to be. How about, let's go outside the wrestler realm. How about Bobby Heenan?
Oh, what a hell of a guy. I got along with him the day I met him. I have a lot of respect for him. You know, he used to come to Memphis years ago and just work TV matches on Saturday morning just in Jonesboro and Memphis and so forth, just to, when he was a wrestler, a young guy. And I tell you, he paid his dues to be where he was, and he was great. He was undoubtedly the gold standard as far as managing, the best.
How about a guy who recently came back to the WWE, and that's Paul Heyman?
Oh, I love Paul Heyman. I get pictures of me and Paul on my wall in my back room. If y'all ever come to my house, you'll see him. Me and him when he had a full head of hair, and I was skinny. Now he's bald and I'm fat. But oh, my God. It's great. I love Paul. And, you know, he saved my life in 1987, I think it was. He saved my life. I mean, literally. A lot of people use that as an expression. He saved my life because he gave me a job, or he saved my life because he introduced me to my wife, whatever. No, he saved my life when I was drowning in the bathtub. Did I tell you that story last time?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay. When I was leaving Alabama to go back to Memphis territory, you know, Paul was there, and Eddie Gilbert, Dirty White Boy, and Danny Davis, and Tom Pritchard, and, you know, just a bunch of us from the Alabama territory. It was all having a going away party for Bruno. It was my last night. I was finishing up, whatever. And we were all drinking beer and carrying on. I don't drink liquor. I've never done drugs. I don't smoke marijuana. I mean, nothing. I've always been a beer drinker. And I can drink beer all night and not even say my words. I just, you know, that's the only thing I've got. I don't cheat on my wife. I don't gamble. I just drink beer. Well, all of a sudden I got filthy, filthy drunk. I mean, to the point where I was spinning and throwing up. And there's even a picture of it in my book, Eddie Gilbert dumping a cooler of ice over me to wake me up. I didn't budge. And then Dirty White Boy kept saying, go in there and take a bath. You'll be all better. It'll wake you up. Go in there and take a bath. And, hell, I went in there and I never come out. And I'd been throwing up and just, it was awful. And Paul Heyman came in to check on me, and I was floating underneath the water in a bathtub full of,
wow.
Well, just face it, piss, shit, and vomit. And he pulled me up, let the water out of the tub, or I would have drowned it. I would have been dead in Panama City, Florida. Period, end of story. He saved my life. And like I say, yeah, I can drink beer with the best of them. Yeah, I might get a little bit tipsy and, you know, whatever. I'm not going to throw up and pass out. Somebody mickeyed my drink. Oh. I got a real good idea who it is. I said who it was in my book. I says, I'm pretty sure. I can't swear to it in the court of law, but come on. I know who it was. I think it was Dirty White Boy. And Paul Heyman saved my life. And I would have drowned it. I would have been like Jimi Hendrix, you know, my own vomit. And it's a fucking shame that somebody would do somebody else that way.
Unreal.
Ugh. So you don't think it was Gary Young that snuck into your house?
We weren't in the house. We were in Panama City, Florida.
Right. It just sounded like a Gary Young rib, that's all.
Oh, yeah, to kill someone? Yeah, oh, yeah. I can see it. Gary Young, Fuji. Fuji would kill somebody probably in a rib. Think it was funny.
All right, Bruno, we got to ask you about one guy that no one else is going to know about.
Okay.
Our good friend Matt, who's a listener of the show and very close. We've been basically brothers since we grew up. His cousin works there, backstage role, John D'Amico. You know John.
Oh, John's a great guy. I just seen him this week.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, our buddy. Matt is my godfather's son. We grew up together. His parents, my parents, are really close. And John... Matt actually got married last year, and John was able to hook us up with a authentic WWE title belt. We put Matt's name on it, and he was over the moon about it.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, John's a great guy. Here's a hell of a story. We were in Glasgow, Scotland in 1993, and I was real skinny then. I was probably weighed 130. Like, I'm 186 now. So, but back then when I was managing, I was real skinny, and John D'Amico picked me up with one hand on my sternum, over his head with one hand.
Wow.
True story.
Wow. We'll have to let Matt know that.
Please do. Yeah, he picked me up with one hand.
Yeah, no,
I don't know if you have to hear this behind me or not. It is thundering so loud outside right now, it's almost scary.
Wow, no, yeah, it's not coming through at all, but that is not
wow.
Good.
Oh, I don't care. I don't have to get off the phone. Or I'm just saying it just passing that out. The weather here in northwest Mississippi right now is scary. It's like lightning and thunder. I get the TV on with the volume off over in the corner, like the weatherman's on there. Take cover, run for your life. And I'm just, you know, standing here talking to y'all, so, you know, tell me more.
Was there, did you get hit? Were you okay last week with Isaac? You didn't get hit too hard.
No, I'm in northwest Mississippi. We just got a lot of heavy rain, the aftermath. But yeah, we're cool. Thank you for asking, though.
I think you meant Isaac Yankum.
Yeah.
I don't know what's better, Isaac Yankum's work rate or a thunderstorm? No, just kidding. We love
it. Oh, boy. No comment. I don't recall Isaac Yankum. Who's that?
That's Glenn Jacobs, became Kane.
Oh, I didn't realize that. You just scooped me on something.
Did you ever think that the Kane gimmick or persona would actually last like this long and become such a kind of iconic
gimmick? Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's a great, great gimmick. And he's a great guy. He's a straight-up family man, a good guy, and he deserves every break he got. Yes.
I mean, he's one guy that you really never hear anything negative about. I mean, you hear so much about everyone, whether it's false or true or made up or whatever. He's just one guy you don't ever hear anything about.
No, and you never will. He's a super-duper guy.
Yeah, go, Scott.
Okay. One guy, we're gonna talk, we might as well talk about it now because he's probably one of the most polarizing characters in the company. And no, I'm not going to say Triple H. But one guy that either you absolutely love him or you absolutely hate him, and that's John Cena. You've been there.
I absolutely love it. He's the most over guy in the world. He's like Elvis right now. How can anybody say against John Cena? He fills up arenas. He sells out concession stands. He you know, with the hats and the shirts and the foam rubber fingers and the necklaces and the wristbands and what have you. He is the man. Anybody that says anything negative about him, they don't realize what they're talking about. The bottom line is to draw money, not to do a 360 hurricanrana double kamikaze knee drop off the top rope. Yeah, big deal. You can go on your little websites and say, oh, yeah, that was a good work rate, and I give him 4 out of 5 stars and 3.5 on that match. You know, go jump in a lake. Let's talk about the business, drawing money, not with some buck-tooth varmint behind a computer that thinks matters. It don't matter that this one guy that weighs 145 pounds can flip 3 times before he lands on you. I got it weighs 145 pounds, can flip 3 times and land on my mother, and it wouldn't hurt her. Let's talk business.
You've seen him evolve, I mean, over the 10 years that he's been with the company since he came on in 2002.
Right.
What was his evolution like from this, you know, kid in OVW with the flat top and then the Thugonomics? What was it like seeing him evolve into the guy he is now?
I'll tell you what it was like. It was fantastic. It was magic the day he walked in. He was one of those guys that I mentioned, you know, earlier about The Rock and Stone Cold, this one, that one. He's one of those guys I could see right away. There was money. And then, again, this is not revisionist history. It's true. Steve Lombardi's seen it. I've seen it. I mean, about the time he was coming along was when Heidenreich was coming along. Just to go to show you that I'm not, you know, blowing smoke up my own ass, I said the same thing about Heidenreich, and you've seen how wrong I was there.
Yes, that's true.
I've seen it in Cena. I've seen it in him. I've seen it in Tyler Rex, which, even though he left to pursue his personal interests, Tyler Rex wasn't catching on or whatever. You know, I have to be honest. So he wasn't a flop. He just didn't pursue it, and it didn't work. But Cena, it worked. From day one, you could see it was just a matter of time. A matter of time.
What are your thoughts about the WCW angle in 2001 with the invasion? Do you think there was more potential there than what was realized? You know, was Vince, you know, I know you're not really in the inner circle or up on, you know, booking decisions or anything like that, but did it seem to you like he did that just to bury WCW, or do you think he honestly wanted it to work?
No, I think he wanted it to work. Vince is not an idiot. He does not want to do something to cost himself money. You know, why would he do that? No, absolutely he wanted it to work. It just, the whys and wherefores of it, I don't know. You know what I mean? But no, Vince is not going to do anything out of spite or animosity, because it's just, you know, throwing money away. He's not, I mean, yeah, of course he's filthy rich. God bless him. He earned it. He deserved it. But he's not going to throw his good money after bad just to be spiteful. No, absolutely not.
Well, Bruno, it has been an absolute pleasure for you to come back. You are, you could say that you know that it is your opinion, and you told some great stories, but you gave the sequel. You were the sequel that no other guest on this show has ever had. So you are you definitely have broken a mold that a lot of future guests, which hopefully will include your good friend Dirty Dutch Mantel, will hope to follow. So,
well, I think that's fantastic. And again, let me just throw two things at the listeners. The one is, please don't forget to go to crowbarpress.com and look for my book, Wrestling with the Truth.
Yes.
For a lot of good stories out there. I think y'all will enjoy it. And the other thing is, much more importantly, if all the listeners would go to Dirty Dutch Mantel, that's with two L's, at gmail.com, or friend him on Facebook. And it's a real, real, to me, it's much more important than my book, more important than wrestling, more important than anything, is keeping drunk and impaired felons off the road. And if we can do that to save somebody's life in your family or your own life, that would be great. So I'd really like to throw that out there. And I say, God bless y'all. Please stay in touch.
Oh, we definitely will, Bruno. We'll have you back again, without a doubt. You're one of our, probably our favorite guy we've talked to so far. So,
well, thank you. And I've really, really enjoyed it. It's my privilege and honor, and God bless y'all.
You too, Bruno. You have a great night, and take care.
Take care. Bruno. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, Scott. I think we touched on just about everything he went through with the rest of his career. And then, you know, really insightful just talking about different guys throughout you know, wrestling history, whether it be if you would book him, not book him, his you know, impressions of them, and yeah, he was honest. So
yeah, I'm really glad that he had nice things to say about Don Morocco, because I think he's always been an understated heel, and you and I have talked about him a lot, particularly when we did our early vaults. You know, he was one of the best heels of the pre pay per view era, and I was glad he got some nice props from Bruno tonight. But you know, he was just a great guy, very honest, very brutally honest in a good way. You know, if you didn't know something, I felt bad. I didn't want to put him on the spot about the Stone Cold thing, but you know, sometimes you're in another part of the building. He seemed like he was always very busy. So it's not like he was sitting around like the friggin' catering guys or, you know, in his other humps.
You know, I forgot I wanted to close the interview by asking him why he didn't get me a burger like he did Shawn Michaels, but, I forgot.
And you, I'm also glad for your sake as well that he had nice things to say about Bigelow, because it's, you know, that's another guy that doesn't get talked about a lot, you know?
Yeah, no, he was, it was cool. I liked, you know, throwing some of the more random guys out there for him to talk about instead of the usuals, right. You know, so that was cool. So, all right, that wraps up our two-parter with Bruno Lauer. Hope everyone enjoyed it. Really insightful. It's cool to talk to someone, you know, a lot of people we've talked to a more modern era, like, you know, our friend John and Eddie Edwards and, you know, Stevie Richards. And, you know, well, we talked to Capetta. But this is kind of a different animal. So it was cool to talk to someone who came up through the territories and had that kind of perspective. We haven't really talked to anyone, you know, on that level yet. So that was really neat. And it was cool. It was a good chat. Hopefully we will be able to get Dutch Mantel on soon as well. So
that'd be awesome.
I'm going to get you right to work on that, Scott. So
no, I'm going to do it. I already got the email written out. So yep.
Very good. Okay, so we're going to wrap up. We will be back next week. And what do we got next week, Scott? We have Canadian Stampede on Monday.
Yes. Monday we have Canadian Stampede. And then Wednesday we will have, since it is the Wednesday before pay-per-view, we'll have headlines. And we will have our week two picks.
Yes.
And Kyle Forchetti will join us again. Sorry, I know it'll be, you know, we're talking about Cowboys. You can leave the room if you
want. Enough Cowboys.
But
yeah, we kind of talked to Kyle, and, you know, he loves talking football. So what we're going to do is Kyle's going to join us every month on the headline show and kind of recap the weeks that were in the NFL and kind of where he sees things going. And then we'll do our predictions as well to round that out. So any news stories or anything you want us to talk about, I'll have a thread up as well for that. So stay tuned for next week, Canadian Stampede and headlines. So Scott, you have a great weekend. PTV Nation, you as well. Yes. I'm Justin Rosero. That's Scott. Take care.
Dirty Dutch.
What? The Blue Brothers.